Hollywood, from patrons of the bar to staff to bands, that sort of thing. And I finally get a chance to talk to my old pal who I used to work with at This Ain't Hollywood way back when it first started. And he was the house sound man that had to deal with all the grief from the bands, all the grief from the patrons, all the grief from the owners, and my grief as well, is always having that constantly help me do Faster and Louder when we did the live to ears with Indie 101 in the back corner. The good one, time. The only, Doug Smith. Hi, buddy.
Hey, G. Good to hear from you, bud.
It's great to chat with you. I've been doing these segments since the announcement of the closure of the bar as of August 4th, and you know, it's just a way of us sharing some stories and kind of get some closure in on what a great bar music establishment it was.
Great what you're doing there, G. I love it.
Oh yeah,
I'm listening to the shows. I love it.
Great, thank you, man. I'm glad that that you've been listening to it, and I've been getting some good feedback, and it's just a way of a little bit of closure for people, because I don't think we're going to be able to squeeze in a show due to this COVID pandemic by August 4th or anything like that. So, but it doesn't mean that we can't do a show later on, not in the same venue,
sure.
But just a closing out party for yourself and everyone who enjoyed the venue. But let's just get right into it.
Sure.
When did you start at the venue?
Well, so I was working at Pepper Jack's at the time. That's, for those who don't know, Pepper Jack's is where the Absinthe is currently.
Right.
And I worked for Kenny for about 10 years. And towards the end there, I started there in 2002, and I worked there about 10 years. And then when the lease was coming up and Ken's family wasn't going to renew the lease, we had that one final show with Peter Hamill, and Lou came to that show, and I remember we had to put a little work into that. We had to find a piano for Peter to play. He insisted on a piano, and so it was a great sounding show. I did a couple little mic things on the piano, and it sounded fantastic, and Lou was super impressed with that. It was a highlight of Lou's life, I'm sure. And he knew that Pepper Jack's was closing, so I guess he pulled Ken aside, had a little chat with them, said, hey, we're opening this club down on James Street North. We need a sound person. Do you think Doug would come and do that? And Kenny gave Lou his blessing. I didn't really know Lou at the time. I remember him coming up to the board and saying, hey, this sounds fantastic. Thank you. He was very appreciative.
Right.
And I didn't really know who Lou was. And at the same time, as word was getting out that Pepper Jack's was closing down, I had other offers coming in from other places around town, like Hess Village wanted to hire me.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I just want to figure out who it is that I might be potentially working for. So I looked into Hess Village. I looked into a couple of the other offers. And then I thought, well, who's this Lou Molinaro guy? I think I'll give him a little bit of research, find out. And everything I found out about Lou is that everybody loves him. His history of booking shows in the city. It's like, you know, I think maybe I'll go there because that sounds like a good promising thing. And I was about, after the bar closed, Pepper Jack's closed, I was out for about 2 weeks, and then I picked right up with This Ain't Hollywood at the very beginning there.
Yeah, and all this stemmed from mixing a show for Peter Hamill back at Pepper Jack's.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did part of the PA from Pepper Jack's come over with you, or
right?
They ended up buying that PA. Okay,
right. So yeah, so Pepper Jack's is closing. He made an offer on the PA system. So when I came with the PA system that had served us so well from Pepper Jack's, and I just incorporated it into the new This Ain't Hollywood. Well, we worked with that for the first 3 years on the same system.
Sometimes you feel so far away, distanced from all the action of the play. Unable to grasp significance, marking the plot with diffident dismay. Stranded at center stage. Scrambling through your diary for a long
Life, love, sleep.
Yeah, that must have been a good feeling, because it's like, you know what you were doing, you're comfortable with it, and then away you go. And then and over the years, you made improvements to the PA system at the St. Hollywood.
We eventually ended up getting another. So the board that I was mixed on at Pepper Jack's was a very simple Allen & Heath GL 2200. Great board. And then so we upgraded. We got another one. Ours was failing, so Lou got us another one. And then shortly after that, we went to digital. We went with the Behringer X32, which had way more options on it, way more control over the audio. It was a much, much better board.
That's it's so funny that someone like yourself who does live audio engineering and you're a guitar player as well over the years, that you didn't have the ability to get air conditioning in the venue a lot sooner.
Oh, no. There was no air conditioning at the beginning, let me tell you. I think the hottest show that that happened there in the early days, when we still have that gold LeMay curtain hanging on the back, was the Jonathan Richman show from Modern Lovers.
Tell us about the Jonathan Richman show. What happened? Because there's a lot of conjecture about that show. Okay. So you give us your side of things.
Well, he's an odd guy. You know, I didn't really get very personal with him, but, you know, he was particular at one. So coming into this at Hollywood, I brought the Pepper Jack stuff, which included the lights, which were 1,000-watt bulbs. And without the air conditioning there, the place heated up pretty quick, you know?
Sure.
And I always tried to keep the bulbs low, so I try to minimize the heat coming out of those things. So Jonathan said to me over the mic, I said, just turn up the lights, turn them up full blast. And I was like, are you sure? It was the middle of the summer. It was 30 degrees outside. It must have been about 45, 50 degrees in the bar with a packed house, full lights. And everyone was just swimming. It was so hot. I think that was probably the hottest show there. Thanks very much to those 1,000-watt bulbs.
Because I hear,
but he didn't mind.
I hear about that all the time. Like people were still bringing that up. Just like they had never been to a show. It felt like a sauna in there. And then I was like, why was this going down? And then I found out later that Jonathan Richman apparently, He doesn't like it. Air conditioning, it affects his vocals.
Yeah. Whatever reason it was, he wanted the heat, he wanted the light, so I brought it for him. And we suffered, but it was a great show, and people still talk about that show today.
Yeah, that was one of the highlights of people's lives going down to that venue.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. happened to Pablo Picasso. He could walk down your street, girls could not resist the stare. And so Pablo Picasso was never called an asshole.
Okay, yeah. So you have an artist like that. That was like one of the hottest shows. And I brought this question up with Hot Carl. I said, "What was the loudest show you've ever heard at the venue?" He said, "I believe it was like Varga would rattle the taps."
Yeah, Varga was loud, but I wouldn't say they were the loudest. But you know, I kind of felt sorry sometimes for the crew behind the bar because the speaker was pointed right at the bar.
Yeah.
So they were getting blasted pretty hard.
Yeah.
Especially in the loud shows. But I think for volume, I would have to agree with Carl that John Spencer Blues Explosion was one of the loudest for sure, just coming off the stage. So when the volume coming off the stage is that loud, I'm essentially running a vocal PA, you know, just trying to get the vocals up over the guitar amps at that point. And so I would say John Spencer was probably one of the loudest. Also, Laid to Rest was a super loud band.
Laid to Rest?
Yeah, Witches was a very loud band as well. Just big old amplifiers cranked, you know.
Witches from Hamilton.
Yeah, from Hamilton, yeah. Yeah.
Really?
They brought in all this old equipment, big, huge amps, and it was just such a powerful sound that they had coming off the stage here. So loud could mean either the PA loud or the stage loud. And when I think about the loudest shows, I think about the stage volume.
The stage volume for you, yeah. What were some of the fun shows that you've seen there that you enjoyed mixing?
Oh, there's quite a few, and I made a couple notes.
So. Oh, did you now? Okay.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Well, tell us.
Because there was so much of it, you know?
Yeah.
11 years of that place. But, you know, as was mentioned before, the Neil Innes show from Monty Python. So he was one of our first, you know, big celebs. We had the Gold LeMay backdrop in behind him. I have photos of it. Neil was so pleased with my sound, even though it was just a simple acoustic and vocal. Most of the time, I think there was a piano there too. He loved it. He gave me a $20 American bill. He said, "Thank you, so much."
That's class.
So he's a very gracious dude, and I remember it was a funny, comical show. You know, I just somebody posted today on Facebook the Ruddles, the scene of them on top of the roof,
right.
And there's Neil as John Lennon, and I was like, ah, you know, this guy has done so much. And I'm just so pleased that, you know, he liked the work I was doing for him and that he tipped me $20.
Did you ever get tipped like that before?
I've gotten a couple tips from people, yeah.
Yeah, but just from that dude is something extra special then.
Specifically, it was Neil Innes from Monty Python who wrote all this great music for The Holy Grail, like one of my ultimate favorite movies. And it was an American 20, so it was what, worth $23 or $24. But I kept that 20. I think I may still have it. Like
won over.
Yeah, don't spend it.
Yeah.
Keep that one. So, in some of the other shows?
Sleepy LaBeef.
Wait a minute. Say that again.
Sleepy LaBeef. I don't know a lot about Sleepy, but Lou prepped me saying he's a big deal. So he's coming and, you know, we'll just do the best we can for him.
Hold on a sec. I don't like how this story's starting. We'll do the best we can for him. You didn't know.
Yeah.
Is this that the dude from Montreal with all the makeup and rolled around on the stage screaming?
No, that's Corpus. You're probably thinking of Corpus.
Ah, okay.
But Sleepy LaBeef, I guess it was big in the 60s, 70s. You'll have to talk to Lou about them, but
okay.
I believe he was a pioneer in some aspects. I think he may have even been from Texas. I know he was from the southern states somewhere. But I went out to the car to help him with his equipment. And here's a tall guy. The guy was like 6'8", 6'10", super tall, big, big man. And I said, "Sleepy, it's nice to meet you." He goes, "Oh, thanks, son. Do you play bass?" I said, well, yeah, I can play. He says, all right, we'll get you up. So, all right. Then turns out, you know, because he's such a big man, he gets winded pretty fast or something. And then again, it was another hot show. He come off the stage. Place was packed. It was like 40 degrees in the bar. Everybody, all his band, his pickup band, were wearing suit jackets. And here I am trying to be as comfortable as possible in just a tank top and shorts. And when he said, okay, we're going to get up the sound man to play bass now. So without any practice or anything, I guess I'm up. So I walked to the stage. I said to the guy coming off the stage, give me your suit jacket. You know, I want to look good. I want to be part of the team.
Sure, sure.
So yeah. I put on this soaking wet suit jacket.
Oh, that's disgusting.
It was disgusting. You're so punk. But it was great. So I ended up playing with the backup band as Sleepy Lippy took a little bit of a break in the back. So, yeah, there's that kind of moment.
We may hear church people say, who are in this holy way, there are strange things happening every day. On that last great judgment day, when they turn some folks away, there are strange things happening. Strange things happening every day. Every day. Every day.
I remember Drum Wars when Carmine and Vinnie Appice came to the bar.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, yeah. You know, and here's Carmine Appice in my bar and working with him, you know.
Yeah.
When there was a moment, as you know, they got there early in the afternoon. Usually the big guys got there in the afternoon. They did like the thorough checks and then they went off to the hotel. And it usually was just myself and maybe the bartender. Lou was there. I said to Carmine, I said, Carmine, tell me a John Bonham story. Because, you know of the history of John being influenced by Carmen. Carmine eventually got John his first big Ludwig kit for touring. And so it was early days of Led Zeppelin. He had that big old natural finish Ludwig kit.
Right.
With the 26 or 28-inch double kick bass. And so I said, Carmine, tell me a John Bonham story. Because they were friends. They became friends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he says, oh, you'll have to read my book.
Oh, God.
And so we kind of laughed, but then he said, well, I said, what about that kit? Where's John's original kit? He says, it's in my basement. And he gave me his card, too, because when they went back to the hotel, he said, if there's any problems, give me a call. And he gave me his card, and I still have Carmine Appice's business card in my wallet. I still carry that.
I thought for a second that you were going to tell me that he sold you the book from the merch table later on or something.
No, yeah. I'm sure he sold the book after the show, but... No, it was just funny that he said, well, you'll have to read my book.
Well,
as soon as I mentioned John, he perked right up.
It's great that you get a chance to meet people that you followed musically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always found it so weird for me when I was younger that, you know, I would be listening to someone on the radio or I would see their videos. And then when I got into my early 20s, all of a sudden I was tour managing rock acts out of Canada. And... Yeah. There's, you know, and you're standing there going, oh, well, this is, I would listen to you on the radio and like, I can't believe I'm actually meeting this person, right?
Yeah. So yeah.
It's for me, it's like, it's always a treat, but I don't want to know them too much when I meet them because I don't want to take away the mystique.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know, because the last thing you want in them is to turn out to be, you know?
Yeah. You know, these people are great. They come to work with you in the afternoon,
yeah.
And they could be the worst divas possible, but some of them just turn out to be the most amazing, nice people.
Right,
and
right.
You think about their musical history, you know, you're like, wow, I can't believe I'm actually... one example was Peggy Young came around, and she booked This Ain't Hollywood so that she could do rehearsals for a couple of days for a Toronto show.
Right.
And she brought this star-studded band, which included Spooner Oldham, one of the original Swampers, who played the organ keyboards on When a Man Loves a Woman. He played all the keyboards on Aretha Franklin's records.
Sure.
He was one of the original Swampers. And he was there at the bar. So it was just the band, Becky at the bar, and myself on sound for I think, 3 days. Just all in the afternoons from about 1 till 5 or so. And I got to hang out with Spooner Oldham. You know, it was just, it's really cool. Like sometimes these people with these great resumes of, you know, of music, I'm standing right next to the guy having a soda or something.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, it is a really good feeling. But and to meet someone like that, you're like, I can't believe, because as musicians, they're amazing.
Yeah,
right.
And you know, I've got to meet like Johnny Winter. Come on.
Okay, so tell me about the Johnny Winter show.
Well,
because
the first time was we were kind of flying by the seat of our pants, but second time we kind of expected what.
Yeah, tell me about the first and the second time, the differences in them.
Yeah. So first time Johnny came around, he stayed on the bus. He didn't come out. His band came out. They did the afternoon sound check. We never met Johnny. And then just prior to showtime that first time, they brought Johnny in through the back room.
Right.
And Johnny was out of it, and it was kind of sad. And Lou will probably relate the same kind of story that he just looked like he was not all there. And
sure.
So he played the show, and it was kind of rough. And so that was our first experience with Johnny Winter. The second time he came around, He had a different manager. In fact, I think one of the players in his band was the manager, and he came in through the back again. He was talkative. He was much more alert and aware.
Yeah.
And that was really cool. And, you know, we had put a little bit of work into that second show, building a stage for Johnny, because Johnny sits down. He's earned the right to sit down. So he sits down, right? And people in the back couldn't see him. So Lou thought, let's build a stage. So we got some staging. We built it up. And it was great. And I have that show recorded. And there was a moment during that show where the rental amp that they were using goes down.
Okay.
So, and it's making this god-awful farting sound. You can hear it on the recording. So the band stops after the number. There's a bit of scrambling on staging. The mics are open, so you can hear talking on stage. And I rush in there, and I grab Gordy Lewis's Fender Super Amp from the back room, which he stored at Disney Hollywood. And it's a 68, I guess it's a combination of 67, 68. So it's one of the best supers. I pushed it up on stage, plugged it in with some help of the guys from the band. Johnny went, duh, duh, duh. He goes, oh, they got the right amp. That was the one. Oh, yeah. So then the rest of the show was great. Johnny was in his glory. He had the Johnny Winter sound.
And
it was fantastic.
All right.
And then the next night, just to conclude on that story, the second time was the next night I was cleaning up and getting ready for the next band coming in the next night. And we had taken down all the staging. We'd sent back to the rental place. And, I was just cleaning up and just straightening up put my monitors back and everything. And under the one monitor, I see this little flash of metal. I said, oh, what's that? I reach under there. It's Johnny Winter's thumb pick.
Oh.
It had fallen between the cracks of the staging and landed up towards the front of the stage. So I have that thumb pick there.
That's pretty coveted.
Yeah, it's proudly displayed. I mean, if you look at it, you can see it's not a brand new thumb pick. It's pretty worn, so we've had it for a while.
Yeah. So, and don't part with that one.
No, it's hanging in my living room right now.
All right.
Yeah.
I want to get to this one just because sure. this is fun for me because it's a lot of this stuff like just makes me laugh because I've always had to deal with people like this and you had to deal with it like every day 7 days a week but let's get right into it. Like you gave us a list of some of the most interesting shows that you've seen there, and we did loud ones and that sort of thing, but we have to get to the one subject matter that makes me laugh every time his name comes up.
Robert Gordon.
Exactly. Now, now, it's not that I have anything against Robert Gordon. I personally don't have anything against him.
No.
But the stories of him doing shows in Hamilton, like I remember Robert Gordon playing in Hess Village.
Yeah.
Causing a bit of a scene. I helped promote a show with him. I think it was at Mermaid's Lounge with my buddy Rob Brealey. It was hilarious. And Robert Gordon is always this guy that is always, there's always these like, oh, and this happened and that happened. He yelled. And I'm just going to tell you my side. I went into the Casbah once back in the day and they were doing sound check and the Shakers were Robert Gordon's backup band. And I walked in and all I saw, and at this time, Robert was like a really big man. Like he had a lot of weight to him, but he was just wearing sweatpants and it was, he just, he looked like this, I don't know, like he just looked like a typical Hamiltonian. Right. Yeah. And, but he's yelling at the light guy and the sound man as they're trying to find the sound and he keeps going, Oh, hey man, you're doing that wrong, man. And I just looked at the guy at the Shakers, and they're standing there. And then the lighting guy was trying to do something, and he was trying to fix the light on Tim Gibbons. And all of a sudden, Robert Gordon says, "Oh, don't worry about that, man. No one's here to see that guy. They're here to see me." And I stood there, and I was like, honest to God, I was crying laughing. And everyone, like, literally going, everyone's feeling uncomfortable, but I'm dying laughing because, and I looked up at the stage, and Gibbons and the Shakers, they love it because they know Robert Gordon's music inside out, right? They played it like it was nothing. So to them, having him being grumpy up front, not a big deal.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
And just to tell you quickly, the look on the sound guy's face was just like, it was just like, oh, I can't deal with this guy. And that's how it leads into this in Hollywood when the first time you mix him.
Right.
And so, but since then you've mixed him several times. What was your trick with Robert Gordon?
Well, I'll tell you, I heard about Robert Gordon, how he leaves a trail of dead sound people in his wake. He does not like poor performances. He's very particular about what he wants.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And so I knew this coming into. I knew he was coming. I heard stories that other people told me about just how of a hard ass he was. In fact, I have another friend who was his backup band at the Corktown show.
Right.
And Robert came in and the first thing he did was tear the cigarette out of my friend, the guitar player's face, ripped his lip, it stomped it on the ground. He says, you know, you can't smoke on my stage. You know? So I knew he was a hard ass. So I also knew that Gordon, he always hired A players in his bands. And one of my most favorite, like Link Wray being a guitar player, but one of my most favorite guitar players that he had, besides Chris Benning, was Danny Gatton.
Right.
Rest in peace to Danny Gatton. Amazing guitar player I've ever heard. I knew that they had put out an album together. And so I was playing it in the bar when Robert came in that afternoon. And it was kind of low volume. You know, it was the tracks that Robert and Danny played on. And so he was just kind of like, I was just like back and forth between the mixer and the stage, just getting stuff ready and making sure everything was all good. And he was sitting at the bar, and he, you know, I hadn't really met him yet, but he was sitting there drinking something at the bar, and he says, "Hey," I went, "Oh, go. Oh, God, here we go." He goes, "Did you put that on for me?" And I said, "Well, you know, I put it on for me, but sure." And he says, "Thanks." And I was like, "Oh, okay. So here's this hard-ass guy. He's being very sincere to me."
Right.
Okay, cool. So that kind of maybe kind of softened the whole ordeal for him a little bit. He went up on stage, and I think people used to come around to see the sound checks just for that entertainment.
Yes, quality. They did.
To the sound checks. So here it was, me and Robert and the whole the room, right? And so, of course, he's trying to throw his weight around. He's saying, "Oh, I don't need this. I want some more of this." And then it occurred to me that Robert problem is that he just can't verbalize what he wants. He doesn't care about the frequency of 250 hertz. He doesn't care about that. He's Robert Gordon. You know, give him a good sound, add a little slap back to his microphone, but it's got to be good. It's got to be authentic. It's got to be like the history of Robert Gordon. It's got to be Robert Gordon.
Sure.
So I said, okay, so I kind of took that approach with him, like, okay, so you're telling me you're grabbing onto your voice and you're going, "I want some more of this." Okay, you want some bottom end. I interpret that as being you want to hear a little more bottom or something, you know. So I worked with him to try and verbalize what it was that he was talking about. And he was very particular about he wanted his monitors facing him. And he was very particular about the volume. He wanted to hear himself over everything. So when Robert came around, he was like the PA inspector. I knew if the PA survived Robert Gordon,
everything's all right.
I was good for the next year, for the whole next year.
That is hilarious.
I could throw anything at the PA after Robert Gordon, and if it stayed true and I didn't blow anything, it was good.
Hey, you have a we've had this chat before, and we were just talking just before we started the interview. You have a whole bunch of mixes that you've done over the years. Now, you have a mix from Robert Gordon with Anton Figg on drums.
That was an amazing show. And, you know, I got to meet Anton Figg, you know, the drummer from the David Letterman late night band.
And Anton Figg, did he not play with Kiss? Was he not a session player? Did he not drum on a Kiss album?
I don't know specifically, but, you know, he's such a smoothie on the kit.
Yeah.
I mean, he's probably played with everybody, and we don't know that it's him until we actually read the credits. But yeah, phenomenal show. And, you know, and he had Greasy Carlisi on bass and Chris Betting on guitar. And it was just a great sounding show. And I think it was because everyone was playing their best with Anton Figg in the band. Anton played our house kit. We set it up for him. He was happy with it. He loved it. He's just a super nice, humble guy, and the recording turned out really good, and I was amazed. And so I'd have to say that that's one of my most favorite, best mixes, recordings.
Yeah, one of your best experiences at the venue then.
Yeah, for sure. So once I kind of like was on the same, or I got Robert to be on the same page as me, and we kind of like, I was on his page, he was on my page, we were okay, we worked well together, and every time he came up, he was always worse. Always asking for me. He wanted me to do the show for him because he enjoyed it. You know, he enjoyed my mixes, and Robert and I must have mixed him maybe a dozen times now.
Right.
He would even send bands up from New York City saying, "Hey, when you go up to Hamilton, make sure you get Dougie to do your sound." Right. So I had one band come from New York City. And, you know, we're just like intermingling around the stage. And the one person, it was a woman, she said, "Hey, Robert Gordon, I'm friends with Robert Gordon. He says to say hi to you." And then she told me that he had said, "Well, when you go up to Hamilton, make sure you get Doug Smith to do your sound." So he's he's pushing me down there in New York City. I thought that was very cool.
That is a great compliment.
Yeah. I sat with Robert Gordon, before, like he had supper before a show. And I sat at the table with him. He was like your Uncle Bob. You know, he's just a very humble guy, but then on stage, he commands the stage. You got to respect that. Hey, this is Doug Smith, the first sound engineer at the St. Hollywood. I just want to say thank you to Lou and Glenn and Jody for having me on board. You've provided me with a body of work that I'll always be very proud of. To my amazing co-workers, my team, my family, thank you for your energies, your strength, your work ethic, and all of your support and friendship over the years. To all the musicians I've had the pleasure of working with, thank you for your talents, your commitment to your craft, and your kind words. The building may no longer be ours, but our community spirit will live on.
Well, come on, everybody, and let's get together tonight.
Listening to The Hawk 101.5 FM in Hamilton, Ontario.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you're listening to a Steel City Music Retro Hour.
Hey folks, here on Steel City Music, the pre-recorded version, as you know. There's a new act. Well, I don't really know if it's a new act. It's a new act to me, personally. I got an email. And I was totally confused at first, which isn't hard for me. It's the John Thomas, their band out of Hamilton. And it's like John Thomas. I was thinking it's like one person, right? And then it's a duo. It's a band. And so as I'm reading it, then the guy says, oh, this is from Julian. I'm like, oh, Julian, what? Julian. And then there's Julian and Dan. I'm like going, oh, no, we're getting into like, Dead Milkman territory where I'm going to be so confused on who's the vocalist. What is this? That sort of thing. But as it turns out, it's all just shits and giggles because they sent me the video as well. And it's actually a lot of fun to watch, too. The single's called Plastic. And joining me right now is Julian and Dan from John Thomas. How are you guys?
Good.
Good?
Good. How are you doing?
Are you guys healthy? Are you wearing your masks? Are you washing your hands? Are you doing all the fun things that we're supposed to be doing?
Sometimes. I'm not wearing my mask currently. I did this morning, though. I went out rollerblading, my girlfriend and I, on the Hamilton waterfront, and my mask got full of bugs. I probably ingested through my nose and mouth about 7. so I got to wash it.
Well, that's disgusting. I'm glad you shared that protein injection into the story. I like that a lot. I started laughing right away when I clicked on the video from your website.